Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So we've had, well, almost a couple of weeks now of the winter retreat, and having a full schedule, been focusing on, of course, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and beginning with mindfulness of the body. And Ajahn Kurum Dhammo has been giving readings, reflections, a couple of slideshows, and you know, giving a variety of perspectives and ways of working with this contemplation of the body. And I think it's Ajahn Kurum Dhammo has been skillful in presenting it, to point out the ways of holding the contemplations of the body, because sometimes it, there's a cultural bias sometimes, or fear of it being a negative, you know, having a negative impact on the mind, or a negative view of the body and of life in general. But that's certainly not the purpose. I have seen people hold it unskillfully, but I haven't ever seen it instructed in that way. I think it's important to remind ourselves what that purpose of the contemplations of the body are, because I think one of the things that's always helpful is sort of over and over again in the progression of developing the mind, the fundamental kind of shift that the mind makes is it's this yathābhūta ñāṇa-dasanam, sort of knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. And that has a transformative effect on the mind, on the heart, and our ability to live within the human condition skillfully and without suffering. And that's the whole point of the exercise of picking up the Buddha's teachings, picking up the practice, is a means of establishing a foundation for freeing the heart, and so to be able to see things in there in a perspective that is going to accord with truth, accord with reality, and that gives a freedom to the mind. There's and I've spoken of this before, but it's always good to recollect, is when Ajahn Mahabua was visiting Wat Nanachat one time. It was maybe about 10 years ago. And he was asked by one of the Wat Nanachat monks what the thought process, what the mind of an enlightened being was like. And Ajahn Mahabua's immediate response was compassion. So that quality of compassion arises out of seeing things in their in their true nature. And certainly I think when we reflect on the human condition, reflect on the human body, I think a very normal result is this compassion and loving kindness. Because when you reflect on that we all are subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, and rather than it being an object of aversion, when it's seen in its true nature, it's a cause for compassion, because there is this level of, I mean, it's hard to be comfortable in a human body. It's just this, if it's not too hot, then it's too cold. You know, if you're not too full, then you're hungry. And there's always something, if you're not, too tired, then you're too wired. And, there's all these, it's so difficult to actually get this sense of absolute, everything's just right. Every once in a while you feel that, but then it slips away. It allows us to really feel a sense of compassion for our own physical body and the human condition, and recognize that is the common experience. And then the uncertainty of life, you just don't know. Like today, dedicating merit for and requesting blessings for a little 2.5-year-old infant who's has a life-threatening disease. And you have somebody like my mother who's, 91 and just, she doesn't understand what illness is. it's just so uncertain. So that sense of compassion, there is no norm really. It's just so sort of uncertain. And even if, one has a strong constitution, doesn't mean that one is exempt from accidents or anything. There's any number of things can go wrong. And when we reflect on it and hold it, and I think what it does is give us a sense of compassion and a sense of kind of patience with the human condition and with each other as humans. And we don't really have that much time on the planet anyway. And so that to spend it in getting caught up in worry, fear, aversion, competition just doesn't seem worth the effort. It's much more fruitful to be inclining to that loving kindness and compassion, and so that those contemplations of the body are very helpful supports for that, and of course it gives one a sense of a sense of ease and ability to to adjust to the and adapt to the changes that happen in a human life, because one is able to recognize that this is what the human condition is. This is what the human body is like. There is this uncertainty. There is this certain fraught quality of all these component parts. It's like the meditation, the 32 parts of the body, and you realize that that's only kind of like a snapshot of some of the body parts that constitute the whole condition, and you think, you know, that it even works is amazing. I mean, it's like, you know, how long have they been working on computers, and they still don't. There's still always these glitches going on with your computers, and human bodies are like way more complex, and they still function, which is pretty good. And it's kind of looking at it in this kind of, oh, there's a certain sense of gratitude that it even functions. Also, you know, one of the classic ways of using that 32 parts of the body contemplation is in dealing with anger and resentment. And one of the ways to help to ameliorate that is to be yes, I'm experiencing anger at this person and because of such and such, but, you know, am I angry at the hair of the head? Am I angry at the hair of the body? Am I angry at the nails? Am I angry at the teeth? Angry at the skin? And, you know, you go through those 32 body parts and sort of, well, where's the anger? You know, and then you says that's where, you know, this kind of deconstruction of things helps to break down the kind of perceptions that the mind loves to hold, and images that it holds, and assumptions that it holds, and so that we can use these contemplations really skillfully for undermining the habit of unwholesome assumptions, unwholesome moods, and certainly the aspects of, say, like ill will, anger, aversion. Being able to pick that apart and be able to try to, you know, kind of on a certain level see a bit more clearly the kind of the absurdity in holding these images of beings, of people, of ourselves. It doesn't really hold up under scrutiny, so that when we can use that contemplation of the body to help to undermine those habits of mind that are unwholesome, and then it, of course, again bringing the mind back, opening a possibility for the mind to return to a place or to establish that quality of compassion and loving kindness. Now, certainly, in terms of my own experience with, say, somebody like Ajahn Chah, who encouraged a lot of body contemplation, and he had such a he held it so loosely, in the sense of there wasn't a sense of tightness of fear or angst around the body. It was always a sense of an underlying wonder and absurdity that we take it so seriously, and I think that's really how I remember him talking about the. There's many occasions when he did talk about it, but he's just saying, oh, it's just like this process of having a body. You know, it comes out of something that's our bodies are formed out of something fairly minor. We start off pretty small, and then we grow and we get larger, and we're then we're born, and then we spend years sort of growing up and getting larger, and then we have an adult life for a while, and then we deteriorate, and some of us get larger, some of us get smaller. But in the end, it just is kind of dissolves, and it's like a block of ice, and you just put a block of ice out into tropical heat, and it just doesn't last for very long. And similarly, in a certain perspective, on the perspective of the world around us and the planet, a human life just doesn't last for very long. It's kind of, it dissolves and disintegrates and passes away, in a fairly short time, comes into being and passes away. And it's sort of like a block of ice that was, it was originally just some water somewhere that was then formed into ice, and it sort of, then it melts and it runs away somewhere, drains off somewhere, or it evaporates, and then it's gone. It changes, and so it's mutating, this transformation. Our human body is similar, and we take it incredibly seriously. But it's helpful to hold a larger perspective, which allows that sense of seeing the nature of the body and having a sense of this knowledge and vision of the way things truly are, and there's a tremendous relief and release there. Our Ajahn Chah talking about they have a skeleton at Wat Bapong in the main hall, and people come into the hall, visitors to the monastery, and they're kind of taken aback by having something, a visible reminder of death and of the, and sort of it's upsetting and has a, it's not a, kind of a shock to some people, and they leave as quickly as they can, why do they have this skeleton in the hall? This is terrible. He said, they walked into the hall. They brought their own skeletons with them, and they got to the monastery. They sat in their car. They walked in. They had to rely on their skeleton. They didn't even think of that. They went back to their homes after seeing this at Wat Bapong and upset by it. But they go, they go to bed and they go to sleep with their skeleton. It's not really reflected on. It's not really considered. This is just incredibly ordinary. And it's helpful to have those images in the sense of it's universal. You wouldn't have a human existence without the skeleton. But then, and you look at a skeleton and you look at the bone and it's, you can't really, think it through of was that a male or a female? Was that a young or old? What were their features? I mean, it's completely indistinguishable when you look at a skeleton. But then that's the nature of the body, and that You know, we impute all these things later. We spend an inordinate amount of attention on it, and it grabs our attention in these ways, and we forget to look at, okay, what's under the surface, what's behind all that. But when we do that, of course, that it has that opportunity for kind of cooling, settling, dispassion, compassion, kindness. It has an opportunity to really allow the mind to let go of some of the assumptions and biases that the mind makes that and results in these ways of that we stir the mind up, agitate it, and keep it suffering. So that being able to reflect using the body. You know, we make assumptions when we're, say, when we're young, and sort of, I mean, just even just taking the body for granted. You know, think of, you know, something like, it just comes to mind, just like, I remember when I was at university, and I had this toothache, and it was really painful. Yeah, and go to the dentist, and I said, oh, just take it out. You know? And you're young, and you just cut corners, take the easy way, and you figure, well, you know, it's 32 of them anyway, so what's one less? And I remember my mom being incredibly upset when she found out. You have to use those your whole life. You know. But that's the these assumptions you make, and you cuts kind of both ways in that sense of not really being able to recognize the benefit of the body, or how to look after it properly, even because it's an impermanent phenomenon, it has to be looked after, and oftentimes we're not really attuned to how to care for it. And again, that's where that when the underlying quality of compassion is fostered, then our own self-perception, as well as the perception of others, changes quite radically. And these contemplations are really for giving us the tools to not create suffering. And that's always that's the Buddha's agenda. That's his mission or his task, is giving us as human beings the tools to reduce our own suffering and the suffering that is created for other people. And so that these contemplations have to be reflected on from that perspective, say, as opposed to the perspective of either our own bias from our own defilements, or the a cultural bias. So it's always, you know, coming back to, you know, what's the Buddha trying to, what's he trying to give us? What's he trying to accomplish? And of course, you know, that is the Buddha's goal, is to give the tools that allows us as human beings to see things in their true nature and free the heart from suffering. And whether it's suffering for ourselves or for others. And of course that whole support of establishing loving kindness and compassion is it's an integral component And when we reflect on the uncertainty of life, you know, the reality that basically as soon as we're born or conceived, then it's just kind of ticking away, kind of waiting for death. And that's uncertain, unsure, very unclear, how, where, when, what, and it's how it's going to play itself out. But that is an inevitability of the human condition. And that's really worthy of compassion, and as well as us, and of course of the appropriate response, if there is compassion in the sense of really wanting to, having that kind of empathy and a kind of willingness to do something to alleviate the burden, difficulty of ourselves and others, then it's going to it requires some kind of effort. It requires some kind of raising up one's interest and energy in order to actually do something about it. And that, of course, that's what the practice is all about. That's what the whole purpose of the training, and training in virtue, training in meditation, training in discernment is for. We have these tools and we have this opportunity to use them, so that reminding ourselves, giving ourselves the encouragement to put our interest and attention onto these teachings. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.